When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Welcome to Democracy-ish. I'm Torre.
And I'm Danielle Moody.
And we got a special guest this week, Adam Serwer. Say hi, Adam.
Hey, how's it going? Thanks for having me.
I wanted to have Adam on after I read yet another of his brilliant pieces. They're always brilliant.
Thank you.
In The Atlantic, The Coronavirus, it's titled, The Coronavirus Was an Emergency Until Trump Found Out Who Was Dying.
Yeah.
And part of me has been wondering, is it kind of a there's clearly a shift of, like, you know, he called it a hoax, and then he was kind of worried about it for a little while, even though he was still on the nothing to see here tip. And then it was definitely like, the cure cannot be worse than the problem. We have to get back to work. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people started saying, like, you know, that shift happened almost the moment that we started to realize, you know, statistically, that Black and brown people were suffering and dying from this at far greater rates than white people. And Adam's piece really nails that down in a more intelligent way than anything else I've seen. And part of it, you bring in this Charles Mills notion of the racial contract. Can you just unpack the racial contract before we get to the meat of the piece?
Yeah, so Charles Mills wrote a book called The Racial Contract, which I really highly recommend everyone read. It's just a really fascinating work of political philosophy, which has been very influential on me. But the idea is basically that a society has explicit written down rules, and then underneath those rules is a set of tacit rules that say that these rules apply in a particular way to white people that they don't apply to other people. And the general example I give of this is, for example, the Declaration of Independence, which says all men are created equal, and which is, you know, has been interpreted by subsequent generations to mean man as humanity, all people are created equal. But at the time, when you look at the Constitution and you look at people who had basic rights, the right to vote, et cetera, it really meant white men with property. So that's an example of something that is superficially universal, but actually has a sort of tacit underlying racial meaning that doesn't apply to, say, Black people in the same way that it applies to white men. And you could see that pretty much the way that works out in modern society all the time. I mean, you look at, like, stand your ground laws, for example, you look at the statistics, you're much more likely to get off under a stand your ground law if you've killed a Black person. When you look at the way that police responded to Tamir Rice, they immediately shot him on sight, even though he's a 12-year-old with a toy gun. But, you know, you can have a semi-automatic rifle on your back and walk into a state legislature, quote unquote, protesting. And obviously no one's going to harm you if you're white. I mean, the terms of the racial contract, as I put it in the essay, are pretty much there for everyone to see it. But it's something that exists almost unspoken and unacknowledged. Because that's the only way you can have a society where everybody is supposed to be equal, but everybody knows that certain people are not, and you treat certain people differently based on who they are.
So do you think that there was a conscious shift in the White House? Like, numbers started coming out of, you know, Detroit and D.C. and New York, that Black and brown people were getting this and dying from this much faster than white people. And, you know, do you envision, like, Stephen Miller, like, running down the hall with a piece of paper, like, boss, like, send him back to work, because it's just right. The Negroes who are dying. We're okay. Like,
I mean, I think Stephen Miller, it has been obviously shaped by white supremacist ideology. That's not news. I mean, that's, you know, what we've seen in his own emails that he exchanged with a young woman who worked for Breitbart, who was, you know, in the alt-right movement and left it, and then gave her gave a big hard drive of emails to the Southern Poverty Law Center. I don't think, I mean, one of the things about the racial contract is it doesn't need, you know, it doesn't need you to think about it to work. You just sort of understand you are socialized to act a certain way. And I think that, you know, it doesn't necessarily need to be the case that the White House is thinking, oh, this isn't really a problem for white people, so we don't need to worry about it. I think that when issues become racialized, people act in that way, even if they don't consciously think about it. Like, there was this, in Wisconsin, you had this this state Supreme Court case over the legality of the governor's stay-at-home order. And when the government's attorney for Wisconsin, the state's attorney, was discussing how there had been an outbreak in a particular county in Wisconsin, and he mentioned that it had been in a meatpacking factory, the Chief Justice interrupted him to again repeat that it was meatpacking workers, and then she specified it was not, quote unquote, regular folks. Mm-hmm. Now, maybe she didn't mean
that. Oh, she meant it.
Maybe she didn't specifically mean Latino people who make up a disproportionate number of meatpacking workers are not regular folks. Maybe she just meant this is a high risk job. But either way, she's separating out these people who are at high risk of contracting the disease and saying they don't really count for the purposes of this law that is supposed to protect everybody. And to me, that reflects a particular calculus. It says, this emergency is only affecting certain people to the degree that it is an emergency. And so, you know, to me, it doesn't really require an extraordinary measure, the extraordinary measures that we're taking, you know, in order to combat the spread of the virus, particularly since it's inconveniencing me, a regular person who is not at risk in the same way. I don't think that there's necessarily, you know, conscious malice involved, but I do think and I think Mills, when you read his book, he's very good at like outlining how this works in different contexts and how it works throughout history. This is really an intellectual framework that underpins, you know, the history of Western civilization. It's not something that, you know, that just like appeared in the last 50 years or something like that. And it's not just something that happens with conservatives. I mean, you can look at New York, you look at police handing out masks in Central Park on a sunny day, and you could see them, you know, slamming a guy to the sidewalk in East New York. So, I mean, like, this is not a thing that just exists. It's not just a Republican thing. It's not just a conservative thing. It is a thing that has, you know, underpins the way our society has been built, which is why it's a problem that persists in almost any context.
You know, what troubles me, though, I think that when we don't call out the intentional malice, like, I have recently... I've gone after several cable news anchors for insinuating that it's not that the Trump administration is evil, it's just that the policies that they are putting forth are not benefiting all people. And I think, much as you are a writer, as a writer, words are important and they matter, right? And so, it is incredibly important, I think, to understand that you don't create policy out of the goodness of your heart. You create at least Republicans don't create policy out of the goodness of their heart. They create it for who it's going to benefit, namely the people that are their donors and their base and what have you. But as I was reading your piece, and I don't remember if you, and so tell me if you did mention it in there, because I don't remember if you did, but what keeps coming up for me, especially after the murder of Ahmaud Arbery, after the murder of Sean Stiller, Breonna Taylor, is the fact that white Americans don't have to abide by the fact that Black people actually have rights, like rights to exist. And what comes up for me is, you know, in the Dred Scott decision in 1857, where they said that Black men have no rights, right, by which a white man should have to abide. And I think that presumption has been ingrained in our democracy, has been ingrained in our culture so much so that when these white folks are out there protesting their right to go to the gym and to get a haircut, It's like, I don't have it. And to go to Red Lobster and to go get a tattoo, apparently, in Georgia, because that's open, because that makes sense. That I don't have to care that you are dying. I don't have to care that you don't have health care. I don't have to care that you don't even make a living wage, but that your pure existence is for my betterment, right? Like, I don't have to be concerned about whether or not my right to protest as a white person, and I continue to say this, it seems to me to be about the right to oppress. It doesn't ever seem to be about the right of what liberty and justice means, two different things. And your piece stood out to me because it was like, yes, if this administration had seen that it was their base, for instance, this was attacking rural communities, it was attacking the Midwest in the way that it was attacking quote unquote blue states, their reaction would be different. So I want you to just talk about the way that we use language and the way that, opinionators like myself versus, journalists who are supposed to be objectivity, how we have these conversations, because I do think that the decisions that this administration is making is out of malice. I don't think that that is just happens to be a benefit of the policy. I think it's the point.
Well, I would say that it almost doesn't matter whether it's malice or indifference, in the sense that the devastation is the same. Mm-hmm. So if whether it's because they're worried about Trump getting reelected and they just want to restart the economy and so they don't care who gets hurt by that, or whether I would describe certainly a lot of Stephen Miller's immigration policies as motivated by malice. It almost doesn't matter. The devastation is the same. As to your point about racial citizenship, I mean, this is something that predates the Republic. I mean, there's even during the Revolutionary War, you have some people in the North who are looking at these principles of liberty and they're saying also slavery is wrong. And then you have other people who are making the point that the colonists are slaves to Great Britain, but also we do have African slavery, but that's okay.
Right.
You have to, and at that point you have to sort of come up with a framework for why Britain enslaving the colonists is bad, but the colonists enslaving Black people is good. And so in that you have the birth of this idea of racial citizenship, which is completely antithetical to the word of the American creed, but inseparable from the way it has actually been executed. And something that I try to tell people, about the history of the United States is when you really think about it, America has only been a full democracy on paper since 1965. 1965 is the first time that the right to vote is guaranteed on paper. And I emphasize on paper because there are lots of different ways to disenfranchise people, even with that commitment on paper. But it has only been 1965 since we have been trying to have a genuine multiracial democracy with equal rights for all. So that project is actually pretty fragile. It's not as old as people think it is, and it's vulnerable. And I think it's vulnerable to the kind of forces that we are seeing being empowered right now.
I think a lot of what's happening on the right, I mean, they are constantly being shaped by race, even while they're claiming to be colorblind, and that the left is the one that's actually obsessed with race, which is complete madness. But I feel like quite a lot of this is also a more relatively modern right-wing GOP obsession, which is that media is wrong, everything media says is wrong, and everything that the left says is wrong. And when you start from that perspective, you kind of get twisted into different positions. And when the media and the left are saying, this is very serious, we need to deal with this, coronavirus, they are sort of stuck in a position of, nope, it's not a big deal, and their only oxygen comes from saying, don't worry about what they're saying, go back to work, y'all, ignore them, because they are the tough guys and we are the snowflakes. So when we're saying, stay at home, fear this invisible enemy, they're the tough guys who say, no, just go back to work. Doesn't matter if some people die. Herd immunity will be fine in the end. I saw a video today, this woman screaming at people in a Trader Joe's that's 99% success rate, recovery rate. If I told you, if you go into some place, there's a 1 in 100 chance you'll die, you'd be like, you know what? I'm just not going to go there. I'm just going to take the smallest precaution. But this sort of sense of like, we are tough and they are weak sort of pervades this whole thing with them. And it's incredibly corrosive to the whole political conversation.
So I think, you know, the sociologists have like a political scientists have a term for what you're describing, which is negative partisanship, which is like every time the other side does something, the other side thinks it's bad, no matter what it is. And I think that's sort of a genuine problem. But I think you're right that you can't, despite this sort of profession of colorblindness, I don't think you can really separate race from this conversation, because when you look at something like immigration, right? If you look at when you look at like the conversation about, say, admitting Syrian refugees, or you look about the conversation, you look at the conversation about stop and frisk, or you look at the conversation about immigration at the border. There's always this sense that any level of risk is unacceptable. Mm. Right. So when it comes to restricting the freedoms of people who are not you, no level of risk is acceptable. There's none of this like tough guy stuff as far as, if I die, I die. You know, life is not about being coddled, et cetera, et cetera. At that point, it becomes, you know, if we have to waterboard people, if we have to never let in another refugee again, if like every Black man in New York has to get stopped and frisked in his own neighborhood, then that is an acceptable risk for me. And I think that it's really sort of inseparable from the concept of race when you say my freedoms are inviolable, even in questions of, you know, even in times of pandemic, even in times when it's sort of a minor inconvenience, even when it's sort of an optional civic obligation thing like wearing a mask. You don't wear a mask to protect yourself. You're right. Wearing a mask to protect other people from you. So it's not right. Like, it's not an act of fear, it's an act of social responsibility.
Right.
So when you say no restrictions on my freedom are acceptable, but any restrictions on your freedom are completely acceptable, regardless of what it does to you, I think it's not a partisan issue. That is an issue of what Danielle was hinting at earlier in this conversation, which is that your freedoms are not as inviolable as my freedoms.
Yeah.
That's not just about liberal or democratic, liberal or conservative. It's not just about Republican or Democratic. That is a sort of a foundational conversation of American history, unfortunately. And it's one that, I think everybody sort of instinctively understood that the pandemic, or at least people of color instinctively understood the pandemic was not going to alter that dynamic.
I think that one of the biggest misnomers about this pandemic was the idea initially that it was going to be the great equalizer. And I, every time, you know, essentially saying that was akin to saying that the election of Barack Obama was going to make America post-racial. Like all of it was steeped in bullshit, right? Because you can't actually have something that is going to be a great equalizer when we're not equal. Right? Like how my body and how I'm able to fight off famine if I have an abundance of food in my fridge and pantry is going to be different from you who has nothing, who has like a handy snack in their pocket, right? Like, and that's what you can afford. And, you know, we make these, I feel like America has been created on all of these wonderful ideals that Donald Trump and the Trump administration and Republicans have kind of exploded over the past 3.5 years, because everything that I thought was ingrained, I didn't realize was just a handshake deal, right? Like everything about our values and our morals and our compassion and you know, and this dream that everybody has the opportunity to get is a handshake deal. America is a handshake deal, right? And what I find really frustrating in this particular moment is this pandemic requires you to have a level of compassion that I don't believe that white people in America have ever had.
Right.
Right? There is a deep level. Everything is foundational to the selfishness that I believe is inherent in America and in white folks here. You should do for me. You should build for me. Your body, breaking your body down for the for the building of this country and this economy is useful. You are of use. And when you are not of use, then you are expendable. But I'm not going to invest. You're not an investment.
Yeah.
You're an investment for as long as you can serve me. And we can go back to slavery and have that conversation. And we can look now at people doing jump squat protests in front of a courthouse in Florida and recognize and seeing that as well, right? It's what you can do for me. And when I talk about white selfishness, white people get very upset. And I think they get upset because it's like, well, you know, don't show me a mirror I don't want to look at.
Right.
And I think that it's important to elevate that when we're talking about what is considered a protest for white folks again, and what is considered a protest for Black people, Black America, people of color.
I've seen certain social scientists, philosophers, whatever, talk about the reason why like countries like Sweden can have the socialist programs, the universal mm-hmm. health cares and such, is because they're all white.
Yep.
Because the demonization of poor Black and brown people has led people to say, well, I don't want my hard-earned tax dollars to go to those lazy people. And that becomes a political breakdown. And why can we not extend social programs out to them in the same way? Which, you know, goes exactly to what you're saying.
I mean, I think there's definitely a sense in which racism erodes the civic bonds that Americans are supposed to have with each other.
Mm-hmm.
I would say that historically, you know, when I think, I'd say historically, you know, in some ways, it's really easy to look at Donald Trump, who is a person who ran on an explicitly discriminatory platform, and say things are, you know, really bad and they're as bad as they've ever been. But I think, you know, on the other hand, you know, when you look at 1876, you look at the end of Reconstruction, you look at the end of this first early experiment with multiracial democracy in the United States, there was really not as many white people who were protesting about that experiment being over at that time as you see today, white voters being extremely resistant to Trump. In some surveys, there's like a certain segment of white voters who have become, you know, in some ways more socially progressive on certain issues than Black people, which is like sort of an interesting cultural artifact. But, you know, I think that it's easy to get pessimistic, but in some ways, white Americans today are more racially progressive than they've ever been in history. In a way that I think we have not seen in numbers ever before, and certainly not in 1965, certainly not in 1867, and certainly not in 1776. I think that doesn't mean that this idea of racial citizenship that is so foundational to the United States is not obviously shaping our politics in a very influential way. But I think that, you know, one thing I don't want people to get the impression, I don't want people to get the impression that these things are immovable, because I don't think that's true. I think they've moved quite a bit.
Really though, Adam? Because yeah. I mean, I asked the question because I try not to make overt comparisons between between Jim Crow, the civil rights movement, and the Black Lives Matter, and the ban of time in between all of that, right? Like, I try not to equate, oh, nothing has changed, because I believe that obviously a lot has changed. But when you can still have two white men jump out of get into a truck, jump out of that truck armed, and murder a Black man who is jogging down the street, and you know good goddamn well you're not going to face, you're committing that act because you know that your whiteness is going to protect you. You know that your ties to law enforcement, or even not, because we've watched folks, these white Trumpist militia, which is how I refer to them, storm government buildings, screaming in the face of law enforcement because they know that their whiteness is going to protect them. That hasn't changed. That reality hasn't changed, that you can, as a white person, take a Black life and know that you will not be penalized for that. You will see no conviction for that. And so it's like, how do we understand and believe that, yes, white people may in fact be more progressive than they are now. But when you can tell me that I just need to be respectful in the face of law enforcement and black people are just disrespectful and that's why we keep dying, but then I show you photos and videos of white people being absolutely and incredibly disrespectful to law enforcement and near a hair is moved on their head, I just don't understand, right? Because it's hard for me in that moment to say, oh yes, we've come so far.
I think on the one hand, you're right. If you somehow woke up Emmett Till, and you said to him, there's a prosecutor in Georgia who tried to prosecute a black grandmother twice for helping someone with a voting machine. And then also when he saw two white men chase down a black man who was running through their neighborhood, and shot him down with a gun. And then he said, there's no crime here. He would say, yeah, that sounds right.
Yeah.
Right. I mean,
that's true. On the other hand, the video became such a scandal that Georgia had to do something about it. And there was a, you know, with certain notable exceptions, I believe it was like just people like Candace Owens who are sort of trying to say that.
Let's not talk about Candace. We don't talk about her on here, Adam.
She's performance art. If she actually believed that stuff, I would feel differently, but she's just performance art.
Yeah.
But for the most part, conservative commentators were like, yeah, this is murder. That guy had no right to do that. And so in one sense, we are still living in a world where someone can assume that they can just, they can see a black person in their neighborhood, kill them, and not go to jail. We are still living in that world where someone can make that assumption. On the other hand, it is not a safe assumption. And for the most part, it's going to be
Wait a minute, Adam.
It is such an explicit revelation of the racial contract that even people who tacitly approve of it, when those terms are not rendered so explicitly, will say this is something horrible.
Is that
not a tremendous amount of progress? Yes, but there is even in this situation, which is like incredibly bleak and incredibly resonant of 100 years ago or 150 years ago. There is a difference between the way that played out then and the way that it plays out now.
You said that there was an assumption that something should happen to them, right, when the video is leaked?
No, what I said was that, on the other hand, when the video was leaked, there was such an outrage that officials felt like they had to do something about it.
Yeah.
But when the prosecutor, the initial prosecutor who initially looked at that case, he saw the video. He saw, you know, he simply decided, oh, there's no crime here. It just requires an incredible, the way I put it in my piece is like, it requires an incredible cascade of assumptions that would just simply not be applied to a black person in the same situation.
I love the way that you put it in your piece. Like, it literally requires you to detach your brain from your body. And like, and also your eyes, right? And to just, you know, because my feeling about Ahmaud Arbery and the idea that we are on our third prosecutor, the idea that initially there was no crime here, you would hit a fucking dog with a car in the street, and that would have been and leave the scene, and that is a crime, punishable by jail.
But you would assume. As a rural an exurban Georgia white prosecutor, that a dog is innocent, and you would assume that a black man is guilty, right? You would assume that he was a criminal. We didn't bring him in. We called the McMichaels. They said he was a criminal. We didn't bother checking. Have there been any break-ins in this area? Is there any crime activity in this area at all? I just wonder. How many Ahmauds are there where there is no video? And we would have never heard of this if not for this video that got leaked out, which they thought exonerated the McMichaels.
Right.
How many Ahmauds are there? Would we even be able to make an argument about these two guys that we killed this criminal who's running through our neighborhood? Like, would we be able to assume, no, you're wrong? Like, there must be hundreds of thousands of Ahmads every Correct. Year that we, yep.
that we don't know
nothing
about.
Ever happens and just passes into history and nothing ever happens.
We, and I think, you know, remember, we didn't hear about this one when it happened either. I mean, no. the national coverage right. of this happened weeks after the actual incident. The other thing I would say is, this is a really important distinction here. It's not even that that the district attorney did not see a crime. He did not see something that was worthy of investigating as a crime.
Right.
Right? It wasn't simply that, you know, it went to a jury and the jury got deadlocked and they're like, well, we're not sure. No, that's not what happened. The guy looked at it and was like, there isn't even anything worth looking
God
into.
God damn.
We're all good here. Nothing yeah. to see here. Two guys just and you know, shot some guy. It's all good.
And the thing is that I also like to say that jogging as opposed to running, right? Because running makes it seem like, oh, this black man was running. What was he running from? Right? Like that's kind of the logic that they are playing with. No, the man was jogging, which implies exercising. And then the man who took the video said, well, his pants were sagging. So I thought that there was something that was, and I'm saying, what? He's running. His pants are sagging. So you assume then, connect all the dots, like you said, the avalanche in which you would have to understand and suspend belief, he's a criminal.
But now we have the second video, or second and third videos, that are supposed to, what, cast aspersions on his character again, because he entered an empty construction scene, and uh-huh. that he took nothing does not matter, right? But that alone somehow cast aspersions on his character and somehow proves for some on the right that he is a criminal, because who does that? Like, why is that a problem? Why is that even part of the conversation that he briefly walked into a construction site where there was no one, took nothing, and left in under 30 or 60 seconds? Why is that even part? Should we also talk about how he went to 7-Eleven before he started and paid for a juice? Like, is that part of this conversation or what?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the reason I didn't want to get into an argument about whether or not he was jogging, because I think it's actually irrelevant to the question. I mean, who knows why sure. he was running? I have certainly, like, I here in San Antonio, there are a lot of stray animals. More than once when I've been jogging, I've seen an unleashed dog that suddenly looked very interested in me, mm-hmm. and I hauled ass away. Because I don't want to get in a fight with a dog that hasn't eaten in God knows how long. But, you know, so you never know why someone is running. To assume that the person running mm-hmm. has just committed a crime is already right. like sort of an incredible assumption based on factors that yep. we can obviously only guess at. But, you know, I mean, like I said, it just requires so many assumptions, both about the person, about the worth of the person who was shot and the worth of the people doing the shooting. There's just so many things that have to go wrong in the assessment. The idea that it's normal, if you see someone running, to get your son, arm yourselves, and chase that person down in a flatbed truck. I mean, it's not, to see that as normal, justifiable behavior is really, I think, kind of extraordinary, and it only works under this, you know, the sort of unwritten rules that we've been discussing.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if the third man who videotaped all of this, if he's going to be arrested or not. He is in the midst of a huge, I mean, I guess, public relations effort. He's been in front of a bunch of interviews, super lawyered up, mm-hmm. trying to act like, no, I was trying to help Ahmad. He certainly did not release the video in terms of saying, like, I'm trying to help Ahmad. He doesn't seem to be trying to help him in the aftermath of him being shot. So I'm not sure why he's now emerging to say, no, I was shooting the video in an effort to try. I mean, just in terms of visuals, I am not certain if the video, I certainly don't see a video being shot with a vigilante intent. But it doesn't also look like a murderous intent. But I can't tell from the way it's clipped. Why did you start filming this moment?
I mean, those are interesting questions that we may, you know, if his crisis managers are doing their jobs, we may never get the answer to.
I mean, the reality is that why does a white man film two white men executing in broad daylight a black man? I'm assuming like entertainment, right? Like, I'm assuming you think that there's some type of there, because I assume the worst in most people. And I think that, you know, we would all serve ourselves better if we actually did recognize that racism exists. I shouldn't have to provide you with video in order for you to believe that. I shouldn't have to provide you with 100 years of documentation. I had somebody tell me the other day, white people have never done anything wrong ever. And I said, excuse the fuck out of me. I don't know what you're talking about, right? Like, literally, have you never read a book? But, you know, the idea here, one, again, camera person, white, not arrested, Eric Gardner, the person who took that video, black person, was thrown in jail, was arrested. Mm-hmm. So I think that, you know, what is very interesting to me, Adam, is this idea that there is obviously a racial contract. There is obviously this racialized citizenship and the degrees in which our citizenship is valued based on our skin color. I just wonder, do we ever move past it? I wonder, because in order to move past a problem or to find a solution, one needs to recognize that there is a problem in the first place. And I still feel like so many decades, so many years removed from the murder and gruesome killing of Emmett Till, like, here we are still trying to convince people, still trying to use our platform and voices to convince white America that there are two separate Americas. And I'm wondering what you think that the responsibility is of journalists and folks like yourself to be able to continue to paint that picture, that there is this separateness. And until white folks recognize that this separateness exists and honor it, can we only move forward?
So, I mean, personally, I mean, since Trump got elected, the work that I've done at The Atlantic, in my mind, is an attempt to create a historical record of the precedents, both ideological, political, intellectual, for Donald Trump. Because one of the things that really struck me after November 2016 was the number of people who were saying, you know, this isn't America, this isn't our country. And, you know, I wanted to be like, no, actually, this is a part of us. This is a part of who we've always been. And this is where it comes from. So I view my responsibility as documenting these things as they're happening as clearly as possible, and mm-hmm. also linking them to our past so we can understand where they came from and why they exist. You know, obviously would like to live in a world where the ideological assumptions underpinning the American caste system and the racial contract as Charles Mills describes it no longer exist. But I feel like as a journalist, my role in that is actually just explaining why these things are happening the way that they're happening, and with clarity, what precisely is happening. Which I think it doesn't make me very different from a regular non-opinion journalist, but I think sometimes, you know, sometimes people think there's a big difference, but I think there's a difference in the way you do it, but there's not a difference in the fundamental responsibility that you have.
Adam, the piece is extraordinary. Your work has been consistently extraordinary for years. So thank you so much for your contribution to the conversation. Much respect.
Thank you guys for having me.
Thank you, no doubt. Adam Serwer, please read him at The Atlantic and on the Twitter and everywhere else. Are you working on a book?
I am working on two books, actually.
Tell him.
One is a collection of, is an essay collection called The Cruelty is the Point. The other is a history of the Black vote since emancipation.
Excellent.
And so one of them will be out relatively soon. Sort of end of this year, early next year, and the other is going to take me a little longer.
I like The Cruelty is the Point. I like that title.
I love it, and I already want to read it. And can I book you in advance to have a conversation about it? I want to get you before Touré.
That's exactly what an inspiring author wants to hear from people when he mentions that he's writing a book. So thank you very much.
Well, congrats. This was amazing, and the article was amazing, and thank you so much for an engaging conversation.
Well, thank you for listening to Democracy-ish. I'm Touré.
And I'm Danielle Moody.
And we'll be back next week.
If there is a country. Pray about it.
Pray about it.
Continue to pray, folks. Literally. Seriously. I don't care if you're an atheist. Just fucking pray. Thanks. Appreciate you.
The praying to the gods of democracy.
Yeah. I don't know who they are, but whatever.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.